This podcast is brought to you compliments of Kaspersky Lab, protecting more than 300 million systems worldwide against internet threats.
Okay, welcome to the Threat Post News Wrap podcast. This is the first one we've done in a long time because Ryan and I have sort of been up to other things, haven't had a lot of time to do this stuff, unfortunately. But this is going to be an interesting one, so it may just focus on the one topic. We might have time to get into a couple of other things at the end. But Ryan, there's been a lot of news and talk the last maybe 2 weeks or so, 3 weeks, about the silly full disclosure debate, which we've both probably written a combined, 50,000 words on in the last, 6 or 7 years.
More like 50,000 stories.
Right. And a lot of it is just repetitive, blah, blah, blah type stuff. Unfortunately, the same arguments get brought up again and again, and people just get so fired up about it. And I wrote a column yesterday, I guess, about my feelings on why none of it really even matters in today's environment, in the sort of threat landscape that we're living in right now. And my argument was that, in an environment where targeted attacks are kind of the problem of the day, and these guys, the attackers are going after, very specific targets that they've taken the time to do reconnaissance on. They're gathering intelligence. They're looking at the network. They're finding the exact machines they want to go after. And they're looking for, any sort of vulnerability to get in there.
Right. And the weak point doesn't necessarily have to be a zero day. The weak point could be anything from a cross-site scripting on a website to a weak password somewhere or.
Yeah, exactly. They don't need zero days to get into these networks. They don't need super advanced attacks to get in. It could be, a careless employee. It could be some 8-year-old vulnerability in IE6. So.
Well, here's my response to that. And we had this conversation offline, which is why we decided to dedicate a podcast to this, is, you're inferring that, zero days doesn't matter. You're saying the disclosure debate doesn't matter, which I kind of agree with. I think there's value to the disclosure debate, even though it's old and musty and, it's been going on forever. There's some value to it, which we'll get to in a second about why the disclosure debate still is important and it still gets, it still gets results. When you say the disclosure debate is not valuable and guys and targeted attackers don't need zero days, then I'd like you to explain to me why zero day vulnerability sells for $65,000 or $120,000 in a high value app, for instance. Why is there such a big market, whether it's legitimate, whether it's these brokers, or whether it's underground shady? Why is there such a burgeoning market for zero days if responsible, if targeted attacks don't really need them? So
I think,
explain your thinking there.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of different reasons. One is that it all depends on the buyer for those vulnerabilities. So let's assume that, the people that are paying big money, $25,000 to $100,000 for a vulnerability, that's a pretty small set of organizations that are paying that kind of money. It's the federal government. It's, a couple of vulnerability buying marketplaces. And that's kind of it, assuming that you're selling it not on the black market, that you're selling it to a legitimate buyer. And if we just take the government, for example, they're interested in defending their systems or having their systems patched against every possible weakness. If you're talking about the Department of Defense, intelligence agencies, military networks, those guys are interested in having those networks completely locked down against anything that can possibly be thrown at them, whether it's known to the good guys or not. So
is that why they're buying zero days?
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think that they're buying them to.
You think zero days or ODs are being purchased for defensive purposes?
Oh, for sure. And also,
you think that's primarily the obviously that's they're being bought for defensive purposes. You think what percentage of zero day purchases do you think are really meant for defensive purposes versus offensive purposes?
Yeah, I think that's kind of an unknowable thing.
I think you're upturning it though. I think when zero days are bought, they're bought primarily for offensive use, and defensive is like a side effect.
You might be right. I don't know. I mean, we both are assuming that the federal government is using, you know, that they have some sort of repository of ODAs that they're using for offensive purposes.
And we're assuming that the federal
– it's right.
Right. We're assuming also that the .govs are the primary purchasers.
I think in conversations that we've both had with people who know, they're not necessarily the primary purchasers, but they're certainly a purchaser.
Yeah, they are an oft-mentioned purchaser, but
yeah.
I think a lot of people use those acronyms and three-letter agencies just to, you know, when you talk in the corridors of security conferences to kind of, you know, get eyebrows raised.
Yeah.
But I think there's a big subset of buyers who are primarily offensive guys who might not be .gov or CIA or three-letter agency. And I think there's a big percentage of that, you know, for obvious reasons, never get reported because
yeah.
If you're selling to those guys, you never make that clear. And if we look back at TJX, I mean, Gonzalez bought a zero day, an IE zero day to use in that.
That's
was
right.
it IE? I don't remember if it was
IE. He did, yeah. I think it was IE.
Okay. So we know for a fact, based on one documented case, that black hats are trading zero days for offensive purposes.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question. I'm not denying that that happens. I'm not saying that doesn't matter. I'm just saying that is sort of a really small portion of what goes on with this stuff. You know, the majority of enterprise networks and especially home users, if you look at any given machine, you know, take the Google example, you know, the Aurora example, which we've used a million times, but Google is a very sophisticated company. You assume that they have a very smart security team, and they had a machine, at least one machine that we know about, running IE6 on Windows XP.
Right.
That, you know, turned into – that was the weak point that let somebody into their network and turned into essentially an international incident. So,
right. But let me ask you this. If you were an attacker, targeted attacker, and Google is a target of yours –
yeah.
Would you even think that you would find success with an IE6 Windows XP zero day? I mean, so it's clear that a lot of reconnaissance went into using that zero day. I mean,
I think
they had already found the target and had known the target was using that specific piece of software.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the way that these guys go about these attacks from everything that I've heard in discussions with researchers and pen testers is that they try everything. You know, they start with very simple known attacks from, you know, years ago that any IDS should catch, any firewall should block, and should not work on, you know, any remotely up-to-date network. And then they go from there. And if one of those happens to work and they get in, that's great. They don't really give a crap if they use an ODAY or if they get in through social engineering. They're just trying to get in. So
right, but at that level, I think a lot of that spray and pray doesn't necessarily happen because I think a lot of the idea of silent persistence is more important than actually getting in. The idea of not getting caught or not getting caught until after you've done what you need to do. Because in this case, you know, these guys got caught. Google realized that they were compromised.
But that was well after the fact.
Correct.
They didn't get caught until
what I'm
well
saying
after
is,
the fact.
What I'm saying, a lot of this throwing exploits and hoping that one sticks is too noisy at that level if we're talking about the kind of quote-unquote espionage that we
– but
that Google says it was.
Yeah, but there's
– we have no evidence about, you know, state-level involvement in this.
No.
There's been no evidence presented. I mean, we're all going on what Google said, who Google said was the attacker.
Right. There's no way to know. And I'm not going to trust their word. I have no reason to.
No, right. But we have no evidence. So, I mean, we shouldn't even be discussing who might have been the attacker there. But what I'm saying is that at that level, if we're going by what Google says, at that level, it's not a lot of spray and pray. It's a lot of very quiet persistence.
Right. But the thing about them getting caught is, in most cases, you know, say a bunch of their early attacks, maybe, you know, say this was like the result of 3 weeks worth of attacks that these guys tried, and, you know, finally they found this one machine that was susceptible to this attack. all the stuff that got blocked, they don't care about. You know, the attackers don't really care. It just shows up in an IDS log or a firewall log at, you know, as some random IP address that tried, you know, some known attack and was blocked.
Right.
I guarantee you they were using, you know, multiple IP addresses in different address blocks. So none of it even looks like it's coming from remotely the same machines.
Place that it's actually coming from.
Yeah, exactly. So the one that actually succeeded, Google really has no way to tie that back to a bunch of stuff that was blocked 2 weeks ago. So it right. doesn't really help them much. You know, the whole point is that these guys got in. It happened to be a zero day in that case, but it could just as easily have been some silly, you know, weak CAPTCHA on the employee login page, like that example I used in my column, or, you know, something else. It's just...
Apache, for instance, Apache got owned recently. It started with cross-site scripting, a simple cross-site scripting that
right.
key hijack that led to a password that led to complete compromise. I mean, it doesn't have to be, like you use a CAPTCHA example, it doesn't have to be a high-profile zero day.
No.
Which brings us right back to the original discussion, which is whether the disclosure debate is useless, because we both agree that, you know, you don't need a high value zero day or a big, you know, something that's unpatched to get in, that's been documented, that's well known.
Yeah.
And when we say targeted attacks, in many cases we are talking about, for the purposes of this discussion, we are maybe talking about Google and some of these bigger companies that have admitted they've been owned. Mm-hmm. There's another subset of targeted attacks that never really get into this discussion, which is those banker Trojans, for instance, that target a small business out in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And those are targeted attacks as well, because they're
sure.
specifically going after the, you know, the spare parts shop in Florida or a Hillary Machinery, which is a little
yes.
machinery company out in Texas. And these are documented cases of guys who've been owned by Clampy, either it's Clampy or some other banker theft Trojan that does, steal money directly from bank accounts and use money mules and that stuff. And
right.
in many cases, the vulnerabilities used there are some old Adobe PDF things that have been patched maybe even 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I mean, when you look at some of these exploit kits and the vulnerabilities used in these exploit kits and these type of, let's call it small scale targeted attacks, they're all old, musty vulnerabilities. I mean, it's documented that the biggest problem is that people don't apply patches on time.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And that, I mean, some people, I think, read my column that way as like, okay, none of this matters because people don't patch. I mean, that wasn't my argument. That was just sort of a side
thought.
It was a supporting point. I mean, that's a given. People don't patch. I mean, we patch and, you know, enterprises patch the applications that they support, you know, like Windows and, you know, CRM systems and Office and, you know, things like that, but they're not patching. They're not forcing users to upgrade Firefox. They're not patching IM clients. They're not forcing users to upgrade, you know, browser add-ons, things like that, or QuickTime, things that are proven attack vectors, that are just as usable as entry points as any other software. That stuff doesn't get patched.
Right, and the attackers, or let me rephrase that, the offensive focus researchers that we talk to will also tell you that it doesn't matter what you do. If the guy has enough resources and enough motivation, he'll get in anyway.
Whether
yes. you patch, fully patch or not, if there's enough motivation, financial incentive, and resources, and he really wants to get in, he'll get in. Because
yes.
There's just the huge unpatchable entry point, which is human stupidity and people who click on things, people who just click on anything. And that's unpatchable. So, you know, just for this discussion, we should document the fact that there's an unpatchable vector that means that anyone can get in at any time as long as there's enough resources and motivation and financial incentive.
Right. That's an old, you know, axiom in the security industry is that there's no patch for stupidity, and it's been proven time and time again over the years. I mean, we both know people in the security industry who are very smart who have fallen for phishing scams, who have clicked on, you know, malicious emails, things like that. I mean, I've
or who's running Windows XP with IE6.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that stuff happens, and it's not limited to, you know, a bunch of completely clueless home users. It's just people are busy. You know, they don't always upgrade when they should. They don't always patch when they should.
They don't always know when a patch is available.
No,
Yeah, that's the other issue. The other issue is things like Java that is really difficult to patch and leave old vulnerable versions behind. There's a million reasons why patching is not where it should be.
No.
And not only because end users don't care.
Or think about something like let's think about like Android or the iPhone OS. You know, that Apple just pushed
iOS.
Yeah, excuse me, iOS. iOS 4 this week, which, you know, we both downloaded, and, you know, we know a lot of other people that downloaded, and I wasn't even thinking of it as a security update, and then I read a story that said it fixed 65 vulnerabilities.
Well, you got to think about it, right? Every time you see Apple issue a patch for WebKit,
yeah, right,
right, on desktops, or issue a Safari patch,
yeah,
all that stuff affects iPhone because the iPhone is just a stripped down version of that. So, and here's the, well, I don't want to get into this discussion.
And we don't have any other way to, there's no other mechanism for us to fix that than
until Apple opt to update by iTunes.
Yeah.
So, in any case, so for months we've been sitting there with iPhones in our hand, vulnerable to that CAN sequest thing.
Yes.
And we had no way to protect ourselves.
That's
there's
right.
No mitigation. There's nothing you could do. You just had to sit there and wait until Apple. So for all you know, all my SMS database and your SMS database might be owned by someone else right now. Who knows?
Sure. Yeah, and there's nothing we could do about it. I mean, we both sat there and watched, you know, that vulnerability get exploited at CanSec West, and we're like, okay, that's terrible. But what can we do about it? And that was, what, 3 months ago?
That's what I'm saying.
So, yeah.
This entire irrelevant debate started because of this, propped up again because of this Tavis Armandy thing, releasing that Windows Help and Support vulnerability, which is still unpatched. And which is now being attacked, by the way.
Yeah, I know.
There's a whole notion. There's two sides to the discussion. One is whether Tavis acted responsibly by releasing it ahead of a fix.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we can argue back and forth about whether he was responsible and whether Microsoft was irresponsible. Who was the responsible party there? The other side of the discussion is whether, you know, his releasing it should be tied to his employer. And that's another discussion I really don't want to get into.
No, I don't either. Because there's no way for us to resolve that. I mean, it's basically it comes down to
Dave Vitale said it perfectly yesterday on its list, which is it comes down to a culture clash.
That's right.
In the United States, when you go do a presentation or anything you do professionally, you do it. It's tied to your employer. You don't go to Black Hat and do a presentation as Joe Schmo. You do it as Joe Schmo Cisco.
Yeah, there's...
You know,
there's,
you're a Cisco researcher there. When the stories are all written and everyone is talking, everyone talks about the Cisco researcher who presented XYZ.
Yep. And there's no way... You can stand up there all day and say...
I'm doing this on my own time.
Yeah.
I'm doing this on my own time. It doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't. Because people, you know, in the security industry know who these people are.
And it's not wrong. It's not wrong for someone to tie Tavis to his employer when it comes to... I mean, a lot of journalists were kind of thrown under the bus because... Well, I was guilty of it, if you want to call it guilt, you know, calling him a Google researcher. Suddenly I must not call him a Google researcher. I've written about this guy for 3 years.
Yeah.
And every story I've written has been a Google researcher. No one had a problem with it. Suddenly I should decide now that he's not a Google researcher anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it takes 3 seconds to look that up on online. I mean, anybody or most...
Google his name. You Google his name. Just Google his name.
Right. I know. And I do feel... You know,
the first top result is welcome. My name is Tavis Armandy. I'm an information security engineer at Google.
Yes.
I'm originally from England, but I'm currently living in. I'm looking at a Google result for his name, the top result. This is the very top result. It's his own website that on the first line it says, I'm an information security engineer at Google. So, I mean, I don't want to get into.
No.
I understand why it's important for a lot of these researchers to be able to do things that may clash with their employers. Policy, so
absolutely.
To speak. Because if everyone were only allowed to do what their employee approved of or according to policy, we'd be living in a world where nothing creative was being done.
Oh, there's no question.
I mean, would you like to have every time you send something out on Twitter to represent your company policy or to represent your company? I mean,
yeah,
there's a certain balance between what I do privately and what I do as an employee. But you know, it's a huge gray area that
it is, and I think that for whatever reason, you know, Tavis sort of got caught in the middle there, and you know, got held up as just sort of, you know, sacrificed in a lot of ways as kind of the scapegoat here for a lot of people's arguments about this.
Right. And the timing was kind of weird too, because we had that Financial Times kind of unsourced, weirdly sourced story that Google was dumping Windows.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people kind of put two together and got 100, you know?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't think it makes any sense. I mean, those are unrelated events as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, absolutely. But let's get back to why the disclosure debate remains important.
Yeah.
Before this Microsoft thing, Tavis released something on, for Java. Remember the Java thing he released two months ago?
Yep.
Because Sun or Oracle Sun or whoever they are now. Determined that it was not important enough, that vulnerability was not critical enough for them to issue a fix. So
they didn't even think it was a vulnerability.
Correct. So he went full disclosure, and they fixed it within a few days they issued the fix. So full disclosure worked. In this case, Tavis claims he spent 5 days negotiating with Microsoft to get a fix out within 2 months. He wanted to give them a 60-day window. He kind of got a lot of stick for releasing the bug 5 days after he sent it to Microsoft. Mm-hmm. But he says publicly that, and Microsoft hasn't denied this, that he spent the 5 days negotiating a 60-day window, and he thought a 60-day window for something this serious was necessary. You can debate all you want whether he's right or wrong, but I mean, Microsoft should get some stick here, which is they sit on vulnerabilities for a long, long time. Critical vulnerabilities, things that lead to drive-by downloads, things that have been attacked in the past. Even the Windows XP, IE6 thing that Google got owned with, they had it in their hands for months.
They did.
They did. And the one after that, there was another one after that, another 0 day after that was being attacked in the wild. And when they eventually patched it, we found that they had it in their hands since September last year. I mean, there's a lot of people in the haste to tie Tavis to Google and paint him as irresponsible just gloss over the fact that Microsoft sits on these things for a variety of reasons. I'm not saying they're sitting on it because they don't care or they don't want to fix it, but they spend a long time doing their patch creation and QA and all their SDL type hacking for variations and all that stuff. It takes too long.
It does take a long time. I mean, I understand why it takes a long time, but I also think that they sometimes artificially inflate that amount of time because we've seen them push out patches, you know, in emergencies within, five days?
Correct. They're capable of getting patches out, I would say, within – let's give them 60 days. I think Microsoft is perfectly capable of patching everything they have in their hands within 60 days. They have the resources.
Absolutely.
But they don't.
No, they don't.
And as we sit right here, they're probably sitting on – I'll make a wild guess, and I guarantee you I'll come in on the low end. They're probably sitting on 100 0 days, critical 0 days that can lead to remote code execution, the type of things that lead to targeted attacks. I can guarantee you they're sitting on more than 100, 150 right now for a while.
I think that's probably true. I would guarantee you that we'll hear from somebody at the MSRC after this goes up.
Well, let me give you an example. I'm looking right now at the ZDI's Zero Day Initiative upcoming advisories page.
Yeah. Which is a pretty good indicator of what's...
This is just one company that reports things to them. This is just one, and we know there are hundreds, but this is just one. Yep. And I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 5 Microsoft vulnerabilities listed here. The one that's most recent is 239 days ago. It was reported to Microsoft, and this is quote-unquote high-risk issues. It was reported in October 2009, 239 days ago.
Wow.
That's the most recent. It goes from 239 to 315 to 327 to 336 to 720 days. So there's actually one sitting there, a high-risk one reported in June 25th, 2008. It has not yet been patched. It's just sitting there.
That's a long time.
So where is the outrage?
Where's the outrage?
Yeah, where is the outrage for Microsoft to be responsible here? No, I'm serious.
No, I know. This is your favorite, and I've heard you go on that exact rant with the MSRC guys.
I have this discussion with them every time I see them, and you know, things take a long time to patch. A lot of times they'll just say, oh, that'll go in a service pack. And so we have to wait 720 days first for the next service pack, maybe. Meanwhile, according to CDI, this is a high-risk issue that can lead to remote code execution.
Yeah.
So when Tavis says, listen, this thing is so serious, I've proven that I can, you know, get remote code execution trivially.
Yeah.
You guys better fix this in 60 days because I think either you fix it in 60 days or I'll issue my advisory and issue my workaround and my mitigation, I think, because I think it's in the interest of security that this mitigation and workaround be issued. Mm-hmm. You really can't fight with him.
No, you can't.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. And I sort of go back and forth on this, but thinking about it, you know, over the last 3 weeks, I think he probably did the right thing because if he's going to disclose it anyway, if Microsoft is telling him that 60 days is the best case scenario, he might as well disclose it right away and put the pressure on Microsoft to get them going on the patch. And in the meantime, let the rest of the community know about the problem. Let them develop workarounds on their own. His, by some accounts, didn't necessarily fix the entire problem.
Right, but Microsoft was able to issue a fix-it, which is that one-click fix-it tool within 6 days.
Yeah, less than that, I think. It was.
Well, let's say he released it 5 days after he told them.
Yeah.
The next day, they had a fix-it.
Right. And that's amazing to me. I mean, that sort of proves your point.
But on the counter, on the other side of it, there's a collateral damage issue where my mom and dad will never know what a fix-it is or what a fix-it is available or track Microsoft advisories.
Yep.
So there's a lot of consumers and a lot of people who get stuck as collateral damage.
Yeah, that's true.
And is that fair to them? Because whenever I have this disclosure debate, I always remember Yvonne Arce from Core Security always stops me and says, well, because we have this disclosure debate, and in our minds, it's always researcher versus vendor.
Yeah, I know.
Finder versus fixer. And Yvonne says, whoa, who speaks for end user?
Right.
Who speaks for my mom and dad?
Yep.
They're just collateral damage that no one cares about. I mean, Tavis's motivation is to get his employer to issue this workaround in their high-value machines. Correct?
Yeah.
I mean, when a fix-it comes out, we are supporting Tavis full disclosure because Microsoft was able to issue a fix-it. And those who are paying attention could protect themselves. But there are millions and millions and millions of users who don't necessarily pay attention to this stuff.
Don't
know what a fix-it is and are sitting ducks.
There's no question about it. Yeah, but
And this is why, like I said, this is why the debate is important. It's important for us to flesh out all these things. Whether it's old and musty, it's important for us to flesh out all these things. And someone has to speak for the end users. Someone has to speak for the researchers. Someone has to be outraged at Microsoft or whoever the vendor is that are sitting on bugs for a long time. You know what I mean?
I
don't think this debate is useless or irrelevant. I think there's value to it. I think the problem is that we keep talking about the same things over and over without looking at all the other subsets of the argument.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that it's a circular argument that's been going on for almost 20 years. And, just to sort of wrap it up, the one point that you just made, I think those same users that are sitting ducks because of this vulnerability, you know, have probably dozens of other unpatched problems on their machines as well that, you know, they've never fixed. So,
They probably are sitting there with Flash version 8.3.
Right, they're running.
Adobe PDF 6 and Windows XP IE 6. No, probably running Windows 98.
Yeah, I mean, I just unplugged a Windows 2000 machine today.
Were you doing? Like, was it like a bookshelf or something? on the internet.
No, it hasn't been on the internet for probably 2 years, but it was still running, and my power bill will probably go down by 30% after I unplugged. It was a monster.
Well, yeah, you're right, though. You're right. The people who aren't applying fix-its and mitigations are the people who are sitting there with – they're in botnets already anyway.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they're sending spam and, you know, collecting Brazilian banking credentials by the thousands.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So where does this end?
I don't know. I mean, I guarantee you that in Vegas a month from now, we're going to hear dozens of people talking about this at the bars. We're going to, you know, have...
As long as I can get a mojito and a cigar, I'm pretty willing to continue the discussion.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I mean, we're going to have a lot of people sort of grabbing us in the hall and being like, look, here's why you're wrong. I'll tell
you. Yeah, especially the MSRC people.
Oh, yeah. They'll be like, here's why you're an idiot. No, you know, that's fine. I've had plenty of people, you know, tell me that, but
I hear that at home, so.
Yeah, it's nothing new. But, you know, it's a topic on which, you know, very intelligent, reasonable people can disagree violently all the time.
And learn something.
Well, that's the thing. I
don't think we're learning, right?
No, I'm making myself dumber right now, but if that's possible. So, all right, enough of that. One last thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
The one thing I wanted to get to was this a story that I wrote this morning or just posted this afternoon about John Oberheide, the security researcher at the University of Michigan, did a talk last weekend at SummerCon about some you know, it was actually like a two-part talk. He told me that, you know, one was about this rootkit that he was able to get into the Android marketplace and get downloaded onto about 200 Android phones by calling it, you know, like a Twilight Eclipse preview or something like that. And it didn't do anything, but, you know, he was showing how easily it could be done.
But doesn't the end users have to click and install to get that thing installed?
Yeah, they do, but there's no approval process for the marketplace. So
okay, so he could get it into the marketplace.
Absolutely, and that's easy. And he was just saying, you know, had this been a malicious application – it was more about the application itself saying, look, I can make this call home and pull down native ARM code that I can then execute payloads on the phone. And Google heard about this and said, hey, would you mind removing that from the marketplace because, you know, it's not really serving any purpose. We see what you're doing, but we'd like you to remove it, which he did. And then he looked at his Android phone a little while later and saw that Google had used this functionality that very few people knew about to remove the application from his phone manually. And he was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. And then he looked at it more closely and found that Google also has the ability to remotely install apps on Android.
Right, so this remote wipe functionality, this remove asset functionality, if you want to call it that, found it was also an add asset, an install asset
feature. Correct. Yep, exactly. And
it essentially means Google has the ability to install an app on everyone's Android device remotely.
That's right, which is, you know, there's a couple different ways you can look at that. One is that it's terrifying because, you know, not just, you know, forget about Google. You know, to take that part out of it just for a second. Just having any company
put anything on your machine.
Yeah, having that capability is sort of worrisome. But the other way you can look at it is, you know, had the application that John put in the marketplace actually been malicious, which we've seen happen a few times now, this would have been a very effective way to get that, you know, to protect users. There's almost no other way for a vendor to get the word out to every user that's downloaded that application that they need to remove it. I mean, how else can they accomplish that? With, you know,
right. I like the security benefits.
Yeah. But does that override the privacy concerns and the other concerns about it?
I don't know. It depends on your perspective, I guess. This install asset feature is one that really is worrisome, especially when you tie it back to everything we know about Google and data collection and their, you know, privacy policy. I think, you know, you were willing to say, let's leave Google out of the equation. And I say,
oh, you can't. I mean, as soon as you say Google, admittedly, I'm not a huge fan of Google. I've you know, written a lot of stories on that, but
just listen to one Moxie Marlinspike talk.
I know.
I used to think that guy was paranoid, like Mr. Super Paranoid, until
no,
you actually sat and you listened to him kind of lay out his case. And then you're like, you know what?
He's not remotely paranoid. He's
not in the least.
And he knows what's going on, and it's terrifying. And, you know, one of the points that John made, I just talked to him a couple hours ago was that, you know, if you can find a way to man in the middle of the SSL connection between Google and your phone, then guess what? You can not only remotely install these applications, but you can essentially do it as Google. And we've seen 8 million different ways for people to man in the middle an SSL connection.
Right.
So it's not even, you know, it's not even
the Google connection, correct?
No. And it's not a stretch to think that this could happen or has happened. Who knows? I mean, I don't know that it's happened to Android users. I don't know that it's happened to anybody, but you have to assume that that people are trying it.
Do you think we'll get an outreach over this fact that there's now an install asset?
It's a really good question.
Google has an amazing ability to kind of sidestep outreach.
There is no question, and I'm not sure how that happened. I mean, replace the word Google with Apple or Microsoft.
Yeah.
Or you know, anybody.
Would you like
else?
To pick up your iPhone tomorrow and see an Apple installed app for something, anything? No.
Oh my God! No. Are you kidding me? Absolutely.
And Google
not.
Will claim they'll never use that, but I see no legitimate reason for Google having that functionality in there. I mean, can you think of any security related any reason that might, you know, keep the phone working properly? I don't know.
I asked John about that, and he said, you know, I don't think that they can use that to modify the OS itself. You know, they can't use it to push patches.
Patches, right. That's what I'm trying to think of any sort of legitimate use for that, and I can't.
No, he said it's a different channel. There's no way or it doesn't look like there's any way for them to do that. It's just to install applications, so.
And someone will find a way to abuse it.
Sure, of course. I mean,
I'm pretty sure that's the next black hat talk on Android, that someone found a way to abuse this install feature.
Of course. I mean, we'll probably see it within 10 days. I mean, there's plenty of smart guys out there with a lot of time on their hands that'll be like, oh, that looks interesting. Let me try and do that. You know, so who knows? But it's just, granted, the presence of Google in that story does
multiply it by
it does. It absolutely magnifies the privacy and data collection and whatever other concerns you have. You know, if it was just some other, if it was Symbian or, you know, who else? I don't know if people get that upset. I mean, people just kind of look at it and go, eh, that's kind of dumb. But now they might look at it and be like, hey, Google, what's with this evil stuff? You know?
It's really tiresome, man. It's really tiresome to see these stories being repeated over and over and over.
Yeah. Agreed. So, all right, well, I think that's a pretty good one. I mean, that's a good discussion right there. And
we should get back on a regular basis schedule with these things.
I agree.
Soon enough.
Yes. Yeah. Once you're
if you stop running to Cyprus and Croatia and Gothic travel.
Yeah. Well, we'll both be gone for about half of July, but we'll be in the same places a little bit. So hopefully we can get a couple more of these done.
All right, man.
All right, dude.
Have a good weekend. Hopefully people listen to this and my inbox doesn't get cluttered with hate mail.
All right.
All right. Take it easy.
Talk to you later.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Compliments of Kaspersky Lab, a world leader in internet threat protection for small, medium, and large enterprises. Visit Kaspersky.com for more information about their line of premium protection solutions.